From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Jennifer Egan's new novel, Manhattan Beach, is already gaining attention, having been long listed for the National Book Award. The story revolves around the Brooklyn Navy Yard during World War II and the first woman to work as a deep-sea diver there. Jennifer Egan, who grew up in San Francisco, won a Pulitzer Prize back in 2011 for her novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad. She'll join us in studio next, after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Set in the Brooklyn Navy Yard during the Depression and Second World War, Jennifer Egan's new book is Manhattan Beach, and it's a 400-page historical novel, a major departure from her Pulitzer Prize-winning A Visit from the Goon Squad. She joins us in studio to discuss her new novel, her return to more traditional storytelling, and maybe even talk about her Bay Area roots. Welcome back, Jennifer Egan.
Thank you so much.
Delighted to have you. And this is the fifth novel, and I suspect a lot of people who had read A Visit from the Goon Squad were surprised to read a historical and Victorian novel with some dashes of noir and Damon Runyon and all that. But this actually was something you were writing before Goon Squad initially, wasn't it?
Well, not writing, but definitely researching. I started doing the research in about 2004, 2005, which is very lucky because a lot of the people that I interviewed in the course of my research were in their 80s then, and some of them have passed on now.
And the research is nothing less than prodigious. I mean, I looked at all the acknowledgments that you went through. Obviously, you were really drawn to the Naval Yard and to that whole world of the maritime World War II.
I really was, and it was a little bit of a surprise to me. I knew I was interested in New York during World War II, and I think some of that arose from 9/11 when overnight New York felt like a war zone, and that was really a shock for all of us. And so I think it led me to think about what New York was like during the Second World War. But the waterfront part kind of sneaked up on me, because what I realized as I started looking at images of New York during that time was that everything pointed out to the water, because, of course, the water was the only way for anything or anyone to get anywhere. And as soon as I started looking into the port of New York during the war and the waterfront, I immediately landed at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, the largest builder and repairer of Allied ships during the war.
And then you have this wonderful character, Anna Carrigan, who decides to be a diver. And again, your research is pretty impressive in terms of going into what it takes with this 200 pounds, that's actually called a dress and the helmet and the shoes and all the rest of it, to go down under.
Yeah, well, that equipment was actually current until the 60s. But yes, it was called the Mark V, and it is the archetypal image that I think all of us probably have of a diver with the big cylindrical helmet and the big, bulky clothing. And yes, I even had an opportunity to wear one of those, all 200 pounds of it, at a reunion of Army divers that I attended. And it is no joke to wear that thing on land.
I don't think it would be much of a joke. In fact, it seems rather onerous when I just try to imagine it, as I was helped by your prose to do. There's also a sense, you're talking about the waterfront, and you know, you think about on the waterfront and all the rest of that, and you've got gangsters here, naturally, and we'll talk about all that. But there's also the mysticism of the sea, which figures into your whole plot in many ways. I mean, the sense of going out and diving under and getting to those depths and actually having revelations, having insights. It's very Melvillian in many ways.
Well, in a way, the sea is one of those things that is both a literal fact and also kind of inherently metaphorical. And I think that was really interesting to me. I mean, so much of our language is just filled with water metaphors. In fact, as soon as you start thinking about it, it becomes very hard not to use them. So I think that made it just a very rich atmosphere to try to explore from every angle. I think some of that honestly has to do with growing up here in San Francisco, where not only are we essentially surrounded by water, but because of all the elevation, I think we're more aware of the water than people are, say, in a more flat place where you only really see it if you go to the edge, like New York, for example.
And I'm not going to spoil anything, but you do actually have later in the novel Telegraph Hill, and we're back in San Francisco to some degree. And actually surprises us that we get back as reader. You're surprised that you're back in San Francisco. Like I say, I'll give away no more than that. But to recreate, I remember reading something that you said about growing up in San Francisco, and you said you've sort of missed the decade. The 60s was where so much of the action was. You grew up in the 70s here. But now you've gone back to the 40s, and particularly kind of the late 30s, moving into the 40s, and have gone to some great lengths to not only recreate the sensibility of the era, but also a lot of the popular culture. I mean, we've got a lot of words like gat and drip and all of that sort of thing, but also, you know, the movie stars of the period and the magazines of the period and all the rest of it. I mean, you immerse yourself in a lot of the 40s.
I really did. I mean, I just felt like to do anything less for me was not enough to feel comfortable to do what I do in that milieu. You know, and one of the things that was surprising to me was that, in a way, you know, having some idea of the jargon and the popular culture of a moment is not that hard to get with the internet. But what I wasn't expecting was how much I would need to know further back than the time I was writing about. Because in a way, you know, we all arrive at the present moment with our own pasts in tow, and that's what we bring to it. So to try to write about a person living at that time is impossible without knowing what their childhood memories are, you know, what that kind of collective memory of a time is for people of all different ages. That was really not something I was expecting, and it required a lot more immersion than I had thought I would have to undertake. And maybe it's good that I didn't know, because I might have been intimidated away by the time I realized how much I needed to know to feel comfortable to do what I do. The way back felt just as long as the way forward.
Well, there's a tremendous narrative drive in this novel that keeps us engrossed and keeps us in many ways remarkably engaged. And in fact, I'm a little hesitant to use this word. Margaret Atwood once said this is the F word, but it is a feminist novel in many ways. I mean, it certainly takes into account just how much women were excluded from things like being a diver. There's a lieutenant named Axel, for example, who's given the opportunity of hiring Anna to do a dive. And, you know, essentially his attitude is women don't dive and I'm not going to go there.
Yeah, I mean, I think for a long time, you know, my work tends to skew male, I would say. And part of that is that I don't like to write about myself or my own life. So writing from the point of view of a man is a very easy way to separate the narrative from me. But for quite a while, I've been thinking, you know, I really want to write a book that at least in part is about feminine strength and how hard it is for that to thrive in a world with prejudice. And so I think when I found myself inclining toward New York during World War II and the Navy Yard, where some 5,000 women were employed during the war, it just felt like the natural moment to get into this material. Now, granted, I do have two male protagonists and one female, so there's certainly plenty of male point of view in here. But in a way, it was sort of interesting to write about a woman dealing with prejudice that is so overt. I mean, nowadays, you know, it wouldn't be legal for someone to say to a woman what Anna's boss says to her, which is, yes, you passed all the tests, but I was never going to let you do this. I just gave you the test so that you would fail. But since you didn't fail, I'll just tell you, you can't do it.
He also uses her as a prop to make the other men embarrassed, too. I mean, that's part of certainly the landscape of gender that you bring us. But you also have a good deal to say in the book about women friendships. I mean, she has two very close friends, Nell and Rose, who speak to us about the nature of women's friendships at that time. And there's a lot in here about fathers and daughters.
Very much so. And that really was a big surprise to me. I was not expecting to write about that. And I have, you know, my kids are now 16 and 14, so I'm starting to move out of the time of having kids in the home. And I've wondered, gosh, am I ever going to write a book about parenthood? Oh, I really hope not. I can't imagine doing that. But as I was working on this, I suddenly realized, oh, I tricked myself by writing a father-daughter story in which it's not about a mother. So I didn't think it would be about my parenting experience at all. But in some way, I think it did sneak in there.
Yeah. And I also have to compliment you on a number of things. You know, you write. I took a creative writing course many years ago from Walter Tevis, the author of The Hustler and many other books, A Man Who Fell to the Earth and so forth. And he said, one of the most difficult things to write about is sex, but you do write about sex well, actually, too.
Well, thank you. I one more bad sex scene none of us needs.
Well, he would say it was difficult because you can't be original because there were so many bad sex scenes, but you actually get into the inner lives of your characters and what they're experiencing here. And I also wanted to say that I've now decided to crown you with a new title, Queen of the Similes. There are similes in here that I think ZZ Packer comes to mind as maybe one of the few. I'm going to ask you to read, but let me give a few examples for my listeners here of the kind of similes I'm talking about that come out of Jennifer Egan's book. I've marked these, so I want to give a flavor here. She says, his pop slapped his face with such force that tears sprayed from Dexter's eyes like juice from an apple smashed between the jaws of a horse. Now, that's something in the original category that you don't, I think, come across very often in the way of simile. There's also one a little bit later on. Let me just get to it quickly, and then I'll ask you to read a passage. You're going to read us an early passage, right?
Yes.
Okay. This is later on in the book, much later on, but I was struck by it, too. It's Anna's aunt, and she's saying, am I losing the page here? You know, I've got two copies of your book. I've got the galley and I've got the regular copy, but I think it's here. Yeah, I think I found it. Brianna, the aunt, joshed with the sailors and filled their glasses like a slatternly den mother. I'm sorry, but, you know, these are striking to me as a reader.
Thank you. What
would you like to read?
Well, I thought I would just read a very short early scene of Anna and her father, Eddie, go to visit a man named Dexter Stiles. And this is now right in the Depression, 1934. And we have some sense that Mr. Stiles and her father form some sort of agreement. We don't really know what it is, and the narrative will jump ahead in time. But what I'm just going to read you now is that Anna and Dexter Stiles' daughter are on the beach in winter on Manhattan Beach, and Anna has waded into the water barefoot. And then her father and Mr. Stiles, whom she's never met before, come toward them on the beach, and her father is clearly unhappy that she is barefoot in the water. Mr. Stiles looked younger than her father, without shadows or creases in his face. She sensed an alertness about him, a humming tension, perceptible even through his billowing overcoat. He seemed to await something to react to or be amused by. Right now, that something was Anna. Mr. Stiles crouched beside her on the sand and looked directly into her face. "Why the bare feet?" he asked. "Don't you feel the cold, or are you showing off?" Anna had no ready answer. It was neither of those, more an instinct to keep Tabitha awed and guessing. But even that she couldn't articulate. "Why would I show off?" she said. "I'm nearly 12. "Well, what's it feel like?" She smelled mint and liquor on his breath, even in the wind. It struck her that her father couldn't hear their conversation. "It only hurts at first," she said. "After a while, you can't feel anything." Mr. Stiles grinned as if her reply were a ball he'd taken physical pleasure in catching. "Words to live by," he said, then rose again to his immense height. "She's strong," he remarked to Anna's father. "So she is." Her father avoided her eyes.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I mean, in terms of where the narrative goes and so forth, we learn later a great deal about Dexter Stiles and about Anna's strength. Dexter Stiles turns out to be a gangster. Let me talk to you a bit about class differences, because Anna's father is a bagman, Eddie, and he plays a central role, as does Dexter Stiles in the novel. But there's a big class difference between that we see early on in terms of who has more money. I mean, just the doll that Dexter Stiles' daughter has compared to what Anna doesn't have and so forth. And then Dexter Stiles, we discover in the course of the novel, is married to a kind of upper-crust patrician, wealthy woman, and so forth. So there are these class divisions that are very sharp as you see it, yeah?
Yeah, well, Anna's father, Eddie, is really part of the Irish waterfront, and that is actually the story that the movie On the Waterfront was telling. And that movie arose from a series of exposés that were published in the newspaper in New York, basically revealing the degree to which the unions were corrupt on the sort of Irish-American West Side piers. So Eddie is part of that world, and he's a very lowly figure. He's lost all of his money in the stock market crash and sort of been forced back to the the kids he to the care of the people he grew up with in an orphanage, and they
saved the guy's life, so they were bonded that way.
Exactly.
You know?
Dexter Stiles has fallen in with a different, much more organized crime group, and this is sort of an interesting thing that I learned in my research, which is that because of prohibition, which resulted in alcohol obviously being illegal, but many people still wanting to drink, organized crime really stepped in to fill the role of moving and selling liquor, and the gangster figure became a kind of a romantic figure that in a way was much more accepted as part of polite society. And so Dexter Stiles got in at the right moment and used his organized crime career for some real to become a very legitimate figure. He owns nightclubs. As you say, he's married this patrician, kind of blue-blooded girl.
Banker's daughter.
Banker's daughter. And he has a great deal of money, and he has a lot of power in that world. He's much more senior in his world of corruption than Eddie is in his.
And there's a sense that maybe these worlds are kind of linked.
Well, yes, they certainly become linked in this particular story.
And in fact, the romantic notion of the gangsters actually goes back to Gatsby in some ways. I mean, in the 20s and the whole spirited jazz age and so forth, there was a kind of romantic aura. I guess it goes back to George Raft, really, in some respects, at least in the movies.
Well, Gatsby is a bootlegger, of course.
Yes.
So, yes, it's and that was fascinating. Like, there was a guy named Frank Costello who was a big, a crime boss in New York. And he lived in an apartment building on Central Park with lots of fancy and even famous people. And so-and-so was a movie star, and so-and-so was a banker, and Frank Costello was a gangster. And they associated together. So that's something that's a little bit hard to imagine nowadays. And there were a lot of gangster nightclub owners. And they had, again, that grew directly out of prohibition and speakeasies and all of that. So there was this period of commingling that was pretty kind of rich and interesting from a fiction writer's point of view.
And from a fiction writer's view, how do we come up with Mr. Q, who's sort of the capo de capo or boss of bosses?
Well, I had a pretty good time with him. That's Dexter Stiles' boss. I mean, just having lived in New York for a long time and read the newspapers carefully, especially when it comes to organized crime, there are a lot of pretty nutty figures in the mix. So this is a guy who basically runs a farm and appears to do nothing else in Brooklyn. And, he has a horse and cart. But in fact, he is an extremely ruthless sort of strange figure who controls Dexter's every move, which is a little bit surprising because we've seen Dexter as a very independent-minded, sort of impulsive person. And when he visits his boss, we realize that, in fact, he has very little independence at all.
I'm talking with Jennifer Egan, and her new novel is called Manhattan Beach. Talking about the awareness of, women being deprived of things like jobs like being a diver and so forth, what could be broadly, generically described as feminist issues. But you also bring a, quote, Negro into this picture, too.
Well, in fact, Anna's position, she does join a team of divers, and there is a quote-unquote Negro, because that was how people of color were referred to then, also as part of that of the team. It is extremely unlikely that either one of them in real life would have been allowed to become civilian divers at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, but for African Americans as for women, war was a time in which the need for able-bodied and capable people to do important work in many cases overcame prejudice. And so it was a time when there was some movement. The Navy passed a rule that prejudice and exclusion of African Americans was no longer allowed in 1942. Now, did that change everything? No. But it was just natural to look at the two of them together in a certain sense because they were dealing with some of the same issues.
Were you fascinated by this period also because of what it represents embryonically about the kind of problems we have today?
Very much so. I mean, I think, I mentioned 9/11 and thinking about New York during the Second World War in light of the militarization of New York that followed 9/11. But I think the bigger questions that 9/11 raised for me were about the trajectory of American global power. I mean, that felt like a real event in that trajectory. I wasn't quite sure what the meaning of it would end up being, and I think we still don't really know. We're still dealing with a lot of ramifications of that. But it led me naturally to wonder about the time when that power amassed and what it felt like to be in the middle of that. So, for example, the banking father-in-law of Dexter Stiles is close to Roosevelt, helped to craft Lend-Lease, and he's really the one who kind of sees ahead of time how all of this is going to shake out for the United States and what an incredibly strong position our country would be in afterwards.
Yeah, he's quite prescient. And on the other hand, you have... And it's kind of fascinating the way you brought this in, the somewhat lovable and wild aunt of the main character, Bran, who hates Roosevelt and, you know, sees him as a scourge, really.
Well, it's interesting. You know, it's easy to think, and somewhat correctly, that everyone rallied around the war and there was this incredible cohesion and unity. And I think it is very striking, given the jagged disagreements among Americans now, that cohesion was unusual. But what was interesting to me, especially reading correspondences, and I got very involved in reading a large collection of letters between two people who got married after they met working at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, there were a lot of people who hated the war and hated Roosevelt and felt we should never have gotten involved. You know, I mean, even after Pearl Harbor. So that was something that I was struck by. I didn't really know that if it would make an appearance in my book. But lo and behold, as soon as Brienne, the aunt, opened her mouth, I found her spouting some of those sentiments. So that was interesting to explore that with her.
But you also captured the war effort, I mean, and the sense of the necessity of people banding together, buying bonds and all the rest of it. I mean, really the feeling that, I mean, just patching up those ships, which essentially was why Anna became a diver, was all part of that, too.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was another thing I really hadn't known until I began researching the Brooklyn Navy Yard, that diving was a huge part of ship repair. That was something I really didn't know, and I think it's still true. You know, a lot is done from underneath while the ship is still in the water, and certainly examining the ship, not to mention salvage diving, which was very important during the war. And in fact, when I, at the same reunion where I got to wear the 200-pound diving dress, I was able to interview a gentleman named Jim Kennedy, who had actually dived during World War II in Cherbourg. And his job, along with many other divers, was to clear the harbor of all the debris that the Germans had blown up and left there to keep the Allies from using the harbor. And he was a wonderful man, and we had a great conversation. And I asked him if he had ever encountered a female diver. And he said that in Cherbourg, he had met a female Russian diver, which was very intriguing to me. I mean, the Russian women did everything during the war. They were doctors and pilots and apparently divers. So that was somehow my little fragment of reality that gave me license to roll with Anna being a diver.
And we're talking again with Jennifer Egan. Her new book is Manhattan Beach. It's all about women diving, and it's all about gangsters, and it's all about New York and Brooklyn. And like I said, it has some setting here in San Francisco, and she has roots here in San Francisco. We'll get into that maybe in the next segment. In the meantime, we'd like to hear from you. If you have thoughts, if you have questions or comments, we indeed invite you to join us. Many readers of Jennifer Egan who perhaps would like to ask questions of her, and you have an opportunity to do that now. Last book won the Pulitzer Prize. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. And you can join us now, again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. Hear from some people who remember the 40s, too. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jennifer Egan, who returns to traditional storytelling. In fact, it's kind of a Victorian novel storytelling in her new novel, Manhattan Beach. She's not only a winner of the Pulitzer Prize for A Visit from the Goon Squad, but also the author of four other novels and a collection of short stories. And she'll be speaking today, 12:30, at Rakestraw Books in Danville, and at 7 p.m., make that 7:30 p.m. tomorrow at Mrs. Dalloway's in Berkeley. Just so you know. And you are also welcome to join us with any questions or comments you might have. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, if you'd like to speak to Jennifer Egan. Or you can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. Let's get a caller on here. Doug, let's hear from you. Good morning.
Yeah, Doug here. So, I was a hard hat diver for 20 years. I worked in the offshore oil industry and kind of worked all over the world. Did salvage work, did a lot of explosives work, and never ran into any female divers. However, I'm pretty sure that the commercial diving schools now have graduated more than one female diver. So that's kind of interesting.
That's progress. Yeah.
Just making a comment on heavy gear. It's an arcane piece of diving gear, but the term heavy gear is because you are heavy, and you can make yourself heavy or light in the water by decreasing or increasing the volume of air in your suit. And a note on the suits, they came in three sizes, a number one for a small guy, a number two for an average guy, and a number three for a tall dude. And the beauty of the heavy gear was that you could make yourself heavy. You could typically, say, stand on the bottom with a 20-pound sledgehammer and bang away on something and not move, which would be a problem if you were in scuba gear or anything that wasn't heavy. So it's still used today because you can do that kind of work on the bottom.
All right, Doug, glad to have that report from you. Jennifer, a lot of this is the stuff that came through your education in the diving business, yeah?
Very much so. I feel like by putting on the heavy gear, as the gentleman says, I miss the part where you feel the reason for it. In other words, on land, it makes no sense, but underwater, it makes perfect sense. And it was really a pleasure to try to write about that experience, even though I never really had it personally myself. But when I spoke to divers, and actually one of the divers I interviewed extensively was the first female Army diver, they all talked about how once you're in the water, all of this discomfort vanishes, and suddenly the logic behind this cumbersome equipment becomes so evident, and there's almost a, you know, there's a kind of a relief and at times almost a euphoric feeling.
Let me thank the caller. Speaking about euphoric feelings, there is Anna has a sister who's brain damaged. We're never quite clear what the problem is, but this one doctor she goes to suggests taking her by the sea, and there's something bracing about the sea. And in fact, it has almost a miraculous, or for a while, I'm not going to give away too much here, but transitory magic effect upon her. What is there, again, in this that was so striking to you? Because you're talking about the depths of the sea and revelation that come when one goes under, like I said, the kind of mysticism of it, but just the feeling one gets from being sort of an observer of the sea and taking it in, literally absorbing it.
Well, I think for me it is very personal. I mean, I think I have that feeling next to the sea that some people maybe feel looking at the stars. It is the thing that somehow connects me to a notion of eternity and continuity and a sense of my spot on my tiny spot on a tiny planet.
I'm sorry, I'm thinking of Chekhov. No, I am, because, in fact, I was thinking so many of the details in your book remind me of Chekhov, but there's a story of his which Nabokov says is the greatest short story ever written, which is hyperbole even for Nabokov, but it's called The Lady with the Dog. I'm sure you know it. And
yes,
there's that moment by the sea that you've just described beautifully as right out of Nabokov, I mean, right out of Chekhov.
Well, I think for me, since I've always felt that way, really my whole life, and there's also an element of fear to it, you know, the might of the sea and the power of the sea, which I think we're confronting in a new way in the face of climate change. And maybe that was another reason I wanted to think about that. But so I think what I was trying to do, although I didn't necessarily think about this explicitly, was come at the sea from every possible angle. You know, there's the underwater part that we talked about. Then there are a lot of people who just want to be on the edge of the sea, which is a feeling Melville describes very beautifully. And then there was another element, which you alluded to, which was shipping itself. And I really resisted having an actual sea story in this novel because I thought, oh, come on, we've got the noir. I'm thinking about, you know, movies from the 30s and 40s. We have this crime element. There's the deep sea diving. I cannot also have people going out on merchant ships. But it was inevitable. And the interestingly, my research for that brought me straight back to San Francisco, where I spent a lot of time on the Jeremiah O'Brien, docked at Pier 45, which is one of only two functional Liberty ships left in this country.
And I'm looking at the epigraph of your novel. Yes, as everyone knows, meditation and water are wedded forever. That's Melville Moby Duck. Let me go to more of our calls, and let's go to Mountain View. Ray, you're on the air. Good morning.
Howdy. I had a couple of quick comments. First one is that I knew a naval diver. She was a graduate of MIT and was diving for the Navy as a naval officer. She did that for I don't know how many years. I don't know where she is now. I haven't talked to her since the 70s. But at that time, she was diving for the Navy. The other comment I would offer is that the Jeremiah S. O'Brien, I went on it once, and what fascinated me most was how they did their laundry. They basically would take a 55-gallon drum, put it underneath the crankshaft in the engine room, and put a mop inside the 55-gallon drum, and then wire it to the crankshaft, and then run the engine for a little while, for a short while, and that would, the plunger going up and down from this massive crankshaft would clean up all their clothes. And but if they let it run too long, it would pulp them. Literally, the clothes would end up being pulp that they could not recover.
Hey, that's fascinating.
That's really great.
Yeah.
I mean, another really fun thing about the Jeremiah O'Brien is there's still a number of docents there who actually sailed during World War II, and they are wonderful gentlemen with fantastic stories to tell.
You heard a lot of these stories. I mean, not only read a lot of them, but actually heard them orally, A-U-R-A-L, yeah.
Absolutely. That was actually one of the funnest parts of the research on this book. I mean, and talking to people, because this I am writing about a time that still exists in living memory, really animated all of the reading I did. So it was a great combination. And in a way, I think I was drawn toward dealing with living people as much as I could, partly because of being a journalist. So I'm very used to getting out there and talking to people. I mean, that's kind of what I do for my other job. And I met some really remarkable human beings in the course of writing this book.
And we should mention that as a journalist, Jennifer Egan's had a number of cover stories in the New York Times Magazine. Some would say it's very difficult to do these both simultaneously. I know you don't necessarily do them. They may be siloed and so forth, but to be both a novelist and use your imagination and to be a journalist where you're pretty much gathering the facts, even though our president would perhaps say you're disseminating fake news. I mean, there really is often that distinction, yeah?
Yes, they're very different in certain ways and yet quite alike in others. I will say that the skills that I've had to develop as a journalist to write long analytical pieces in which I've had to process a lot of information really helped me in approaching the research for this book, because I think having so much technical knowledge about which I knew nothing, like deep sea diving at that time or ever, the Merchant Marine, U-boats, torpedoes, and then the Brooklyn Navy Yard and shipbuilding, there were moments when I felt there's just no way I can become conversant enough to really move around in these settings and milieus. And I think having had my years of experience as a journalist just made me able to even approach the amount of know-how I needed to acquire.
Well, I mentioned there's an article about you in a recent New Yorker, and I was a little surprised to find out that you seem to have some investment in astrology, but that was just one surprise. But a bigger investment appears in literary theory, which you took at Penn and you credit as having influenced you to a great deal.
To some degree. I don't know if one would feel that so much in this book, but I think some of the narrative playfulness that I've enjoyed using in other books that tends to call attention to the actual process of writing the book, I think some of that does date back to literary theory. I mean, and another thing I think I really enjoyed doing in college was using literature as cultural texts. And in a way, some of that did help me in this book. I'm kind of thinking aloud because as useful as all of the nonfiction that I read to just try to learn what I needed to learn about the 1930s and 40s and some of these very technical things, reading fiction was as helpful or more helpful in terms of really giving me a sense of the inner and private lives of people at that time.
So, I want to know what you were reading, but I want to also comment on the fact that you do go into the inner lives in ways that are really quite striking. I mean, it's almost as if sometimes you're going into a simultaneity of emotions that are experiencing by the character. I mean, you've got what they're saying outwardly and then what they're experiencing inwardly, which is, you know, good, like Victorian novel writing. Were you reading Victorian novels?
I'm always reading Victorian novels. I mean, it's such an interesting period for the novel, and a time when the novel probably had its greatest cultural power because there just wasn't much else. So I just love the way fiction did a great deal at that time. The novels are very long. They were often serialized, so there is a kind of nail-biting cliffhanger quality to them that I think speaks to the fact that, you know, the writer really wanted people to come for the next installment. And they had certain structural qualities that are they're probably more reminiscent to us now of serialized TV, because there are certain things that come about through serialization, like multiple characters, you know, following a story over time. There's a kind of roominess in those books.
Well, you've structuralized this into 8 parts, and, you know, you can see how you move, how you navigate, dare I use that word, you know, between these 8 parts. And it's really also has suspense built in it, because a lot of it's so well plotted, which I know you must have gone through a lot of excruciating pains to make sure that suspense and those ingredients were there and that secret sauce, whatever it may be. You're in a writer's group?
Yes, I have a writer's group. We meet, you know, on an as-needed basis and read work aloud to each other. So it's not so much about having people help me polish things as bringing stuff in at a very early point and finding out whether it has a pulse. Sometimes I find that out before anyone has said a word, just from the experience of reading it to them, because there's nothing like, you know, hearing your words either landing, you know, like lead or sort of tingling in the air to give you a sense of whether the material has a kind of excitement about it. So I find it extremely helpful. And it also, it makes me attend to the music and the rhythm of the language in a way that I might not otherwise. And I think a lot about the fact that storytelling really did begin as an oral tradition. And that component of it is just crucial. I mean, it should sound like a captivating story, ideally. So I'm very reliant on them for, you know, and in fact, when I originally thought I would have a lot of structural bells and whistles in this book, particularly leaps forward into the future, I had all kinds of crazy ideas about what I would do. They were the ones who quickly slapped that notion out of me by telling me that it was a nightmare. And at one point, someone just said to me, "You need to stop."
Well, there's no PowerPoint in this novel, for those who are familiar with Goon Squad. You mentioned the pulse of a novel, though, and the pulse of the cadence and the rhythm of the language and so forth. And I was struck, I knew somewhat your late brother, Graham, who I admired very much and who in the acknowledgments you write about, giving you the notion of a gunpowder and the importance of gunpowder in a work. That's what sets the work on fire? Ignites the work?
Well, I remember talking to him. It was actually while I was working on the PowerPoint chapter of Goon Squad, and I was having so much trouble really making anything happen there. I couldn't seem to really make it work or go anywhere. And we had dinner, and he had such an uncanny ability to just say the right thing to me to help me get over whatever was stopping me. And at that point, he said something about how it just needed every work of art that's any good has to have some gunpowder in it. And that really helped me. I can't quite say how. You know, he was schizophrenic and struggled enormously in his life, but managed to be the most reasonable, you know, sane man in the world, despite that, and always very, very helpful with creative difficulties for me.
And was actually a fine artist himself.
Very much so.
Let me bring another caller on here from Oakland. Don joins us. Don, you're on the air.
Yes.
Hi.
Turn the speakerphone off. Ms. Egan, I come from a small town in New Jersey, Winfield Park, that was built as a government housing project for shipyard workers in the Bayonne shipyards, just as we were going in the Lend-Lease in World War II. Were there any communities in Brooklyn that were built just basically as emergency housing for shipyard workers?
Very much so, yes. And they are now New York City housing. But yeah, right in my neighborhood, right around the Navy Yard, there was a housing project that opened in actually during the war. So it predates a lot of New York City housing, and it was explicitly to house shipyard workers. So absolutely. And those complexes exist to this day. And it all dates back to the war.
And let me thank you for the call and remind you, you can join us with Jennifer Egan either by phone, toll free 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. She is author and winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for A Visit from the Goon Squad. Her new book is Manhattan Beach. And again, she'll be speaking at 12:30 today at Rakestraw Books in Danville, and at 7:30 tomorrow at Mrs. Dalloway in Berkeley. Let's talk about chronology in general here, because, I mean, this novel, as I said, sort of came into being and was gestating all during writing the Goon Squad and so forth, and then came to fruition after, though a lot of it was plotted before, I recognize. But the way you plot things, often chronology gets shifted too. I mean, it's almost sometimes reading a novel like this a bit like reading two novels, because suddenly we're 5 days before after we've moved through all of this narrative chronology. And those who know Goon Squad know that there's a lot of shifts in chronology there, even into the future. So remember the last time we talked, we were talking about Proust and time and so forth. Has that added another dimension here, or is that coming? Because this is pretty much linear, except, as I said, then we get 5 days earlier in what seems almost like another novel.
Well, that is one of those shifts that I had trouble quite lining up chronologically. It's not ideal to suddenly move readers to 5 days before, but believe me, it was the least of many evils. No, it's interesting to think
about.
Why
is that an evil? I mean, actually, I thought it was quite innovative and interesting as a reader.
It's interesting to think about the way time played out in both of these books, because one thing that's interesting is I hadn't plotted this book until I started writing it, because that's my sort of strange writing process. I sit down and I don't really know who is in the book or what will happen. And so I started doing that in 2012. So while I was writing Goon Squad, what I was doing was interviewing a lot of the people that I talked to for this book. So people in their 80s, a lot of women who had worked at the Navy Yard, a gentleman who grew up next to the Navy Yard. So people at the very, toward the end of their lives, the final act, looking back on their youths and talking a lot about, formative experiences that they had had as young people. And I think that is really what got me thinking about time in a way that led me to write Goon Squad. So in a funny way, the thinking about time started with research for this book, led me into Goon Squad, and then when I finally got to writing this novel, in a certain way, I was, telling a story in a much more linear way than I did with that, because this book is not really about time, whereas Goon Squad is. But the two really are connected in that the research for this book was somehow thematically kind of flowing into a lot of my thinking about time for Goon Squad, which is a book explicitly about the passage of time.
I think this book also is in many ways about time. Now, I'm saying that as a reader. You're the author, never the twain. But there is my recognition as I'm reading this about the evanescence of time and just how fleeting time is. In fact, even Dexter Stiles, the gangster, uses the Latin for time flies at one point.
Well, of course, there's something that's so clear, and you're quite right, which is that we all know that we're reading this book in the present day. I'm writing about people who would probably no longer be living, many of them. So there's a kind of relationship to time that I'm establishing with readers where we all agree to travel together imaginatively back to a moment that is long gone.
Yeah, it's time travel.
Yeah, and there is a kind of poignancy just built into that, which has to do with retrospect. And I think the poignancy comes also from recognizing that this moment is just as fleeting, and there's no way not to be aware of that as you're thinking about the past.
Well, in the profile of you in The New Yorker, there was recognition of the fact you were walking in different areas that appear in the novel, and the writer of the article said, you were speaking of the characters as if they actually lived there. I mean, those characters become that vivid to you or that real to you? That was her perception.
Very much so, yes. I mean, for example, with Look at Me, where I wrote about Rockford, Illinois, which is where my mother's from and where my grandparents lived, and I spent a lot of time as a kid. When I think about Rockford, I have to remind myself that some of what I'm quote-unquote remembering about Rockford are experiences I wrote about there involving people I made up and not experiences that I had there myself. Now, part of that is because I don't write about my own life. You know, in a certain sense, these characters that I invent somehow occupy, have the same imaginative status that my own past ends up having.
They cast real shadows. So how do you separate memory from fiction, I guess, becomes a challenge, especially as we go into that last act. Many people who can't separate them.
Well, I may become an odd conversationalist at that point, but so far I seem to be able to keep them separate when I think about it.
Did you go back and also immerse yourself in, you know, there's a lot of mention of Lana Turner and Betty Grable and Tyrone Power and Victor Mature and all these screen stars of that era? Went back and familiar. I have a feeling you may have even read some old screen gems and things like that.
I definitely watched a lot of noir movies. And in a way, the whole was more than the sum of the parts with those movies. There's a feeling from them that I think was more important to me than any particular one. Although I will say The Naked City, which is a film from the late 1940s set in New York, was really great. I watched that a couple of times. It's very stylish, kind of self-conscious noir, and it showed me some interesting things, like the fact that in the outer boroughs there were still horses in New York in the late 40s, which is not something I had realized. But yes, there's a very, you know, to the extent that I play with some genres in this book, one is certainly the genre of the sea story, which is a rich and tremendous genre unto itself, but I'm very self-consciously playing with the noir, somewhat in terms of the way people talk to each other, the kind of snappy, movie-ish lingo that was kind of fun to use. Although I discovered something interesting, which is that in correspondences that I read between people at that time, they talk the same way. I'm not sure that was invented by Hollywood.
Well, I think there was a difference between New York noir and Los Angeles noir. I mean, when I think of Los Angeles noir, of course, I think of Marlon Brando. I mean, excuse me, of Raymond Chandler. When I think of New York, I do think of Brando and on the waterfront. So there is a kind of divergence there of sorts.
True, although no one had the lingo better than Chandler. I mean, those are wonderful books, and his protagonist is such a poignant figure. Philip Marlowe is really an interesting character, the detective, very lonely, very urban, strange, lonely, and I think sort of closeted figure.
An archetype. But speaking about closeted, is Mr. Voss a closeted gay in your novel?
I think that becomes yes.
I didn't know if it was explicit. I just had to ask. Okay, let me get a caller on here from Stockton. Gary, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Great show, because I'm an ex-commercial diver myself. I did commercial diving for 20-something odd years. I went to the Ocean Corporation in Houston, Texas, and worked in the Gulf of Mexico. But one thing I'd like to mention, the lady that wrote the story, Manhattan Beach, there's a great organization here in California, the Historical Diving Society, located in Santa Barbara, California. Anybody that's interested in a lot of colorful characters and figures that were instrumental in hard hat diving, not just men, but women as well, you can go online and look up the Historical Diving Society located in Santa Barbara, California. And they, every year, they have diving orientations where interested parties can join an orientation where you actually can experience the hard hat diving with the old heavy gear. As a previous caller said, size 1, 2, and 3 suits, and even the new modern gear, the Superlight 17s and 27s as well. But,
well, you're going to get our author, Jennifer, going down there maybe to give it a try, as well as many of her readers. Thank you, Gary. That's good to know. And I'll get another quick call on. Richard, that's you. Hi. Welcome.
Yes. I was a Navy diver after I got out of school, a diving officer. Also trained in the mixed gas rig. Which, and by the way, we called it the diving dress that you wore, and which was vulcanized rubber. But the air rig was 200 pounds. The mixed gas rig was 300. And, of course, you had one diver in the water, but you had one diver sitting in the rig on the surface ready to go in to rescue him if needed. When I was an undergrad, I was also in the Merchant Marine, and I shipped out of Brooklyn. So I had a lot of stories, a lot of interesting.
You're going to love this novel, and thank you for the call, Richard.
You're welcome.
Good to hear from you. As we come up to the end here, there's almost a kind of wonderful symbolism in what sets Anna into this world of underwater diving. She's able to very deftly undo a knot. And that's really the test in some ways. I mean, not only all the physical things, but to undo it quickly with all that equipment on.
Yes. Well, in, you know, dexterity was interestingly one of the qualities about female workers at the Navy Yard that was acknowledged to be often better than what men could do, and also kind of physical limberness. So, for example, women were not allowed on the ships initially, but then they found that, oh, they can fit into these small spaces and bend in ways that men can't. So it was, you know, Anna's dexterity was one of those qualities that I knew she would have. She sews a lot with her mother. But it was when I, as I was doing my research, I learned that that actually would be have been something that was tremendously valued about her, and that, that many women had that could bring to their industrial work and contribute something that, that sometimes the men could not.
Did you get into any of the Rosie the Riveter type stuff in your research?
Oh, sure. I mean, Rosie the Riveter was a propaganda campaign to get people to come work in places like the Brooklyn Navy Yard.
And a lot of women were available only because the men were not, because so many of them were shipped out and fighting the war effort. Jennifer Egan, always good to have you here. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure.
The book, again, is called Manhattan Beach, and she'll be 12:30 this afternoon at Rakestraw Books in Danville and 7:30 tomorrow at Mrs. Dalloway's in Berkeley. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Remind you, you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. And you can continue this discussion on our website, kqed.org/forum. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.